my name is Farah. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is November 24th, 1993. And Midtown Group is my home group, and Beth is my sponsor. And I'll let Noah, should feel pretty comforting to me because it sounds like my house with all my kids running around. So I should feel pretty at home. I want to thank Billy for asking me to speak. You've been trying to get me out here for a while, but schedule conflictions. But so thank you very much. And it's been actually great to finally meet you because we've been talking on the phone a lot. So it was great to finally, you're a really, really, really nice guy. It's been nice talking to you and stuff. I guess I'll just start. I've never spoken for an hour before, so you're going to have to bear with me. This is my first time. But I guess I'll just start from the beginning. I grew up in an alcoholic home in Hawaii. My mom and dad are both alcoholics, my uncles, grandparents, you name it. It kind of spreads roots everywhere. And I grew up in a, it didn't seem so bad at the beginning. You know, I didn't really know what was going on. I used to pass joints for my parents when I was, like, just able to walk. You know, I found that stuff out later. And, you know, but everything, my life to me seemed very normal for a long time. You know, when you grow up in that kind of environment, until people start questioning it, it doesn't seem abnormal to you. And I remember, yeah, I just remember, you know, I was very friendly with police stations. My mom was a really bad alcoholic. My dad was in the military, so he was gone a lot. And then he got incarcerated when I was 7. And at that point, my mom's alcoholism kind of just went overboard. And she was constantly being brought home by the police. You know, we were taking ambulance rides. She'd pass out in stores. You know, we'd go to the beach, and she'd get in an accident, so I'd have to hitchhike when I was, like, 7 years old, I guess, hitchhike from pretty, I mean, it's hard if you've never been to Hawaii to tell you, but from, you know, a very bad part of town up, you know, a very far away. And I ended up hitchhiking in a bathing suit at 7 years old, you know, and the people, luckily I got picked up by really nice people, and they got me on a bus and stuff like that. And this was just, you know, normal everyday stuff. You know, I ate any more beef stew out of a can and cereal because my mom would always pass out before cooking. And, you know, one day we went to, she decided to go to the store to get something, and she passed out in the entranceway. And my first ambulance ride, and I went to the hospital. I was there when they pumped her stomach. I got to see what it looked like for someone to have their stomach pumped. And I never went home after that. I got put into the system. I became a foster child. They realized that that was just enough times, you know, that it was an unstable house. So, you know, I was pretty much raised by foster home, by foster home, by foster home. I bounced around to a bunch of them. And, you know, you get to see some very interesting things from some pretty messed up kids. And, you know, I never really thought that I was really, I wasn't actually. I was just a very quiet, people wouldn't believe that knowing me now, but I was a very, I never really talked much. I was kind of like that, you know, person that just kind of blended into the wall. Like, no one really in school knew who I was. You know, I didn't really have any friends. And obviously before I got taken, people didn't want really come over very much either, because you never know what you got with a mom being at home. You know, I couldn't really have friends ever at my house. And actually, to backtrack a little bit, before I got taken away, you know, I definitely got, and this is kind of important in my story, because, you know, my mom used to physically abuse me when she was drunk, and I ended up being the same kind of drunk myself, which is why I say that. You know, I used to hide in cabinets from her and stuff, because when she drank, she would, you know, she would just get crazy, and, you know, she would start hitting me and stuff. And I definitely turned out to be the exact same kind of a drunk. And so, you know, before I took any kind of a drink, I just felt like there was some kind of mistake, like I shouldn't be here. Something always felt wrong with me. And I definitely could not socialize with people at all. And I was kind of, you know, we had, didn't have very much money either. I'd go shopping at Goodwill. So I'd have these little Pollyanna dresses with those bibs on them. I don't know if anyone recognizes what I'm talking about, but hideous. And then, you know, so I took, before that, I kind of, you know, my mom would drink vodka and 7-Up. So picking up her glass, it's clear. I didn't know what it was. And I would take sips of her alcohol every once in a while and spit it out and go, gross. I'm never drinking. Look what it does to her. why would I ever want to do that? And I was in elementary school, and all my friends were drinking these wine coolers. And I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. Well, not all my friends. People were drinking. I say all my friends. I didn't have any friends. And I picked one up, and I drank one. And now wine coolers aren't very much. I mean, to me, I ended up being a straight vodka drinker. So, you know, but at that time, they're like, it's like a free drink. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. And I started feeling a little good, you know. Would tuck in those bibs, those Pollyanna dresses, and I started feeling a little, you know, outgoing, and I started to realize what it started to do for me, and it really quickly progressed, and mind you, I'm still in school, you know, I started cutting school to get drunk. The middle school I used to go to, which is 7th and 8th grade, had really tall grass, literally up to here. I don't know why they didn't cut this grass, but it was very easy to cut school, lay back and drink, and not go back to class and just stay there. And every once in a while I'd get busted and I'd have to do detention and stuff like that. And so quickly, you know, it just seemed like once I picked up that drink, my life just started to go somewhere completely different. And for me, it felt like, I hate to say I'd arrived, because I feel like everyone always says that, but it's like something just clicked, and I just finally just felt like I could just be, you know, I could be somebody else. People liked me. I was more outgoing. I was fun, you know, and I quickly started getting into fights, obviously, pretty soon into my drinking as well. And, you know, I would fill up soda cans, with vodka or alcohol and bring them into class with me. Obviously, progressing, I wouldn't pay attention, obviously, at school at all anymore. Ended up getting kicked out of high school, and I had to go to this, I had to sign a contract to, I'm kind of progressing a little bit, I'll go back, I get nervous, it's all over the place, but I had eventually, you know, I got kicked out of high school because of, you know, my drinking, my behavior never showed up, I got in a fight, you know, whatever. I would even bring those gallon orange juice, those milk containers that have orange juice, but I'd keep just a little bit of orange juice in there and fill the rest up with vodka and make screwdrivers. And that was, you know, before my first period of class and when I would drink on the bleachers and stuff just to kind of get me through, you know, the class day and stuff. And but when I got kicked out of that school, the only other school that would accept me was a school that had this trailer in the back, and it was a rehab for the kids in school, and I had to sign a contract saying that I would not drink, you know, and I would show up to classes and all this stuff. And the only thing I really remember about this outpatient rehab thing was they would show us this video, they asked me a bunch of questions, and that we'd all go and get high behind the trailer afterwards, or drink, at that point, I was actually living in a clean, sober house, which is not very cool to do. And now, if I think about even if someone, I would absolutely kick them out, and that I put them in that position was, you know, not very cool as well. But the house manager had actually called me, and I'll backtrack on how I got into that. But he called me right after I had drank in a bottle, and he had an intuition that I had drank. And he said, "Have you been drinking? For some reason, I got hairs on the stuff. Stood up and back of my neck that you've been drinking." And I was like, no, why would I have been drinking? And I came up with some excuse and hung up the phone. But I ended up in that house. So my mom had gone through a couple rehabs, and she'd finally gotten into this one that had a halfway house. And there's not very many halfway house or treatment centers in Hawaii, but there's actually two. One they developed later for teens, called Vi Benson Center, but you have to pay cash up front, and I wasn't able, my insurance wouldn't cover it, and they wouldn't send me in there because it was too much. And then the Second Chance Rehab, which later closed because the director was smuggling drugs through there. So I went to go live, you know, with her in this clean, sober house, and she drank and she left, and I didn't want to go back to foster home, so I stayed there. And I stole money from the people who lived there. I drank under their roof. I would search the cabinets for anything that had alcohol in it, mouthwash, extracts of any kind, and I'd get drunk. And they ended up, and I'd sneak out in the middle of the night, steal the car, to go get drunk and do other things. And they finally, you know, they locked me in my room, and they put me in a room with bars, you know, and all this stuff. And somehow I'd always, oh, the the one thing they didn't think of was the bathroom for some reason had an exit door, which was right next to my room. So I would sneak out that way and leave it unlocked. And and the kind of drinker I was, you know, I would get drunk. I hit one girl on the head with a crowbar. I couldn't even tell you what she did to me, except she was trying to talk to me and be my friend. You know, and she was just a nice girl in the neighborhood. She lived a couple blocks from me. She was a straight-A student, you know, really nice girl, you know. Her name was Anita, and she was a really nice girl. She just wanted to be my friend. Why? I have no clue. And we're riding the bus, and there was a, I don't know, God, I felt like it was God at the time, but there was a crowbar under my seat. And I picked it up, and I hit her on the head with it. And you know, of course, I didn't really have any consequences except for she would not come from here to the entrance anywhere near me. She would run away the other way. And so would I if someone hit me on the head with a crowbar, you know. You know, things like that always happened. I blacked out every single time I drank. So a lot of my drinking is really fuzzy. I usually remember, you know, a couple drinks, and then I would come to and, you know, people are being held back from fighting with me because I had done something to them. People would tell me about the bruises they've gotten from me the next day. Violent drunk, just like my mother, pretty much. And at that point, you know, I kind of see that in my sobriety a little bit now, but I started to harden a lot. And, you know, before then, going back a little bit, I was seeing psychiatrists since I was in elementary school, because the teachers would see bruises on my body from when my mom beat on me. So I started seeing psychiatrists then, all the way into, I think, my second sobriety date that I'd had. And they didn't really do much for me, but I wasn't really looking for anything to happen. They kept suggesting that I go get help myself, that I start going to AA. And it's funny now, I mean, because the psychiatrist would say, you know, look at you. Your hair is brittle. Your skin's yellow. I mean, you look horrible, you know. And I looked in the mirror, and I saw beauty, you know. I saw absolute gorgeousness, and I felt on top of the world. You know, minus, you know, I had, and it's so funny, because I started out with no friends before I started drinking. I started to get friends at the beginning of my drinking, and they kind of all went away, you know, towards the end of my drinking. And then luckily in sobriety, I've gotten more friends. And, but, you know, and at the beginning, you know, I guess I was fun. I was definitely outgoing, and I would do anything. I would do anything drunk. And so people liked hanging around me until, you know, people would start assigning guards to the bottles, because I would drink all of your supply, you know, all of it, and I would always manipulate my way into getting that bottle, you know, or whatever it was, and I would do anything for it, and I loved drinking. I loved the way it made me feel. I loved that I felt like I could be whoever I wanted to be. I felt like I could just escape my, you know, my alcoholic mother, who I could not stand, and I wished every day that this woman would die. And I hated my dad, you know, because he was in prison for 12 years, and he wasn't there, and he was an alcoholic beforehand, and still today, he's out of prison now. But, so I prayed for a long time for my mom to die. And when I was 16, my wish came true. You know, she died. And, she died drunk. She, you know, had another relapse, and she decided to take a bath, and she drowned in the bathtub. And you would think that would keep someone sober, you know, and it didn't. I thought for a long time until last year that I was actually sober, you know, after that, but I really wasn't, and because I was in the drunk constantly that whole year. And you know, I don't know. Today, I don't hate my mother. Today, obviously, I wish she was here. But, you know, because now I understand the disease a little bit more, you know, me being going through the program and stuff and knowing, you know, she did the best she could. You know, her mother was an alcoholic, a really bad alcoholic, you know. My relationship with my grandmother until she actually just passed away last year consisted of phones being thrown at me, you know, knitting needles being thrown at me, and, you know, bad words always. And that was my relationship with my grandmother. And I actually got to go a couple months before she died. I got to go down. A friend of mine, Anae, came down with me, and she was in the hospital for a little while. And I'm so glad that I did that, because I couldn't stand her either. And, you know, she was actually sober for a little while through the church before she died, but drinking pretty much had done, you know, she died of cirrhosis and stuff. And, you know, I was glad that I went down there. I definitely did not want to go down there. But, you know, it was good, and I got to make my peace before she went. And I've done a lot of things that I have not wanted to do in sobriety, but every time I've come through the other end, they've always been the best thing for me. I also did another men's trip last year, really soon after she died, actually. I went back to Hawaii to make some amends, and that was hard, and I had an upset stomach all the way down, and I had to change. It basically took 24 hours to get from here to Hawaii, because I had two layovers, and it was really long, and I was by myself, and it was also, you know, there was someone from an AA that from my area getting married down there, too, so I know going there, I was going to be with people, which was great, but it just so happened I wasn't able to get on the same flight with somebody. But it was good, because I definitely had empty bowels from my ride down there, and was a little nervous that, you know, there was going to be an accident, but didn't. And, now I felt like I also had, I was afraid of that whole state, and who would have thought that just going back and making a couple amends would make me comfortable going back somewhere. And, I don't know, I thank God for my sponsor, because my sponsor definitely makes me do things I don't want to do, you know. And even, you know, coming up on an anniversary, I'm still stubborn as hell. I still don't want to do things all the time. You know, I don't like change by any means. I don't like change. I like consistency, and whatever it is, if, you know, staying in whatever, you know, happy, resentment, whatever it is, I like staying there. But there's actually one other resentment that I've definitely been working on. I have to call that person soon on my anniversary to thank them for my sobriety. And it's an old sponsor of mine who had left a little while ago. And I asked my sponsor when I could stop calling him. And she said, whenever you or that person dies. I was trying to auction off some people to go kill him in Texas. I couldn't tell you what exactly. I mean, I had a couple different sobriety dates. The first time I came in, I was court ordered to either go to Al-Anon or AA. And at that time, I was living in that clean, sober house, raising a ruckus, drinking under their roof, stealing from people who lived there, a crazy maniac. And they took me down to this meeting at Kahimohala, which is a mental hospital. And at first I was like, I'm going to go to Al-Anon. Mom's an alcoholic. You know, I'm too young to be an alcoholic. I'm going to go to Al-Anon. And so I went to this Al-Anon meeting, and for some reason, and I don't know if they set this up on purpose, but their Al-Anon meetings start before the AA meetings do, and they get out beforehand. And you have to walk right past the door, which they have these huge doors open. You can hear everything, you know. And I walked past, and, you know, obviously today I can see it was God. Something just stopped me in the doorway, and I just listened, you know. And the person at the podium was basically telling my story, you know. And then, you know, of course, my alcoholic ego is like, well, there's people I live with that are there. They're going to tell them what time I walk by, and, you know, it's all staged, and, you know, whatever, which no one thinks about me that much. Only I think about me that much. And so, you know, I had asked to go to another one, and they were more than happy to take me, you know, some more meetings. And I had gone out to a going-away party for some friends, and got drunk again, and I had woken up in the back of a pickup truck full of beer cans. They weren't mine because I didn't drink beer. I only drank vodka and whatever else you had, but preferably not beer. And I woke up in the back of this pickup truck. I don't know whose it was or where I was. And there was an AA camp out going on that weekend. And so I called my house, and I was like, can you come pick me up? I'm over here. And they came and picked me up, hungover, and took me to an AA campout. And that is the last place that you want to be hungover, is an AA campout. And I'm talking about camping. Not like camping here. I mean like tents, camping. And that was pretty unbearable to me. And that wasn't my last sobriety. I had one more. I had gone out again, and then I got sober on, at that time it was Thanksgiving Day, and from the sobriety date was Thanksgiving Day. And I felt pretty done at that point. You know, my detoxing was someone sitting on me, because I'm kicking and screaming and just trying to punch and kick and bite anything I could. And literally, the person sat on me until I was exhausted and couldn't move anymore. And then, you know, started going to meetings again. And at this point, like I said, I had another sponsor before when I was in. She was an Al-Anon and AA, and I had gotten a second sponsor the other time I came in from someone who did parking lot sobriety. You know, this is obviously my second sobriety. You know, I found her out in the parking lot talking, smoking cigarettes while the meeting was going on. To me, that was appealing. I wanted what she had. Everyone was gathered around her. She seemed cool. You know, and obviously, I got the results of that. You know, I ended up drinking. And so this time on my sobriety, I had gotten this woman who ran a step study in Hawaii, and she was very active. She was a member of this group who they went out on the beach, played volleyball, and had cookouts, like, every weekend, and, you know, was very active. I'm still living in Hawaii at this point, and I asked her to be my sponsor, and I started, you know, and up until this point, I wasn't really doing, and thank God I even stayed sober this time, because I didn't do, I'm a lazy person, and I don't want to get in and look at myself. I hate looking at myself. Even today, I have to fight to take my inventory. It's like pulling nails. Because I don't like seeing. I like to live in the delusion that I'm a nice, sunshiny person who everyone likes. I don't hurt, which is definitely far from the truth. Because when I'm not taking my inventory, I'm far from that, definitely. My sponsor usually gets the phone calls, I hurt her feelings or someone else's feelings or make people cry or whatever. That's me not taking my inventory and looking at myself, you know, today. So, you know, I went to, ran around with her. At this point, it was the most active I had ever been. And mind you, AA Hawaii AA is a lot different than AA out here. You know, and they do a lot of fellowship in, not a whole lot of it, very much anything else. The young people's group out there is horrible. At least it was when I lived out there. Basically, what they would do is sit in there for the readings, then go out and smoke the whole time, or interrupt people, or whatever. Basically, living like how they did when they were drunk, pretty much. So, you know, I did my first four step by burning it. No one ever told me to save it, 'cause you might need it for your eight step. So I burned that one, you know, and the ceremonial burning thing. Didn't really get much out of that one because I didn't really do... I was really afraid to open up and tell this person all about me because I was afraid I was going to get kicked out of AA, you know, and that people wouldn't want me here anymore because of how... I mean, I would... You know, even when my mom was still alive and I lived with her and she got drunk, I would beat her up, you know, and she would wake up and ask how she got bruises or cuts or whatever, and I would say that she fell. Because a lot of times she would fall and pass out on the floor. But a lot of them were caused by me. You know, it was getting out my rage and how much I hate her, and I would just beat on her while she was passed out. Or throw... I really love to get these big buckets of ice water with lots of ice and dump it on her head for that reaction when a drunk wakes up out of a... And they're... That, I loved. It made me happy. But anyway, regardless, I was not a very nice person. I did another four-step. Like I said, she did a step study. And I did a fourth. It was obviously all women at the step study, but they had this big dry erase board, and you had to put the worst thing on your four-step and on your sex inventory on this board for all these women. And there was like 20 women in this group, and I waited. I would hide behind couches, go to the bathroom every time, hoping that they would forget about me, and of course they didn't. And soon after that, I fired her because then I was afraid. And I kind of went solo for a little while. I didn't really talk to her very much. Actually, I don't even think I fired her. I just stopped really talking to her. And I started hanging out with this other crowd who, you know, I started getting comfortable in AA again. You know, you forget what it's like after a little while when you're not doing anything. And I started hanging out with these young people that it was more fun to go and do whatever, you know. But I was sober, but we were going to clubs after meetings and crazy things like that. And there was only me, and I don't know if this other guy still is sober, but there was only two people sober out of, like, 20 people that used to go. And we used to go to this place called The Dungeon. And we rationalized why we could go to this place, because they didn't serve alcohol, but people brought in alcohol and sold it to people. So there was still alcohol there and whatever. But we rationalized why we could go out to this place. And so, you know, I did things like that, you know, and I stopped really working the steps. I never really took any 10 steps, you know, didn't really take a look at my inventory. I wasn't praying. I wasn't talking to a sponsor on a daily basis. Thank God I stayed sober. I don't know how. I really could not tell you how I stayed sober. And I was sitting in this meeting, and this lady, Jun Lee, walked in. She was all energetic. She was talking about this conference. Here, Jun Lee. She's talking about this conference, IKIPA, that was coming to Hawaii, and yay! And I was like, who is this woman, and what the hell is IKI something? And I'd never heard of it before. It did not sound very good. And she was saying they were having these elections for it, you know, at this hotel, the Sheraton Hotel in Hawaii. And, you know, we went, and they had, you know, some elections, then they were looking for a place to hold the not-so-important positions, you know, like not the chair or secretary or treasurer and all that stuff. And I raised my hand so we could have it, you know. Mind you, it wasn't my house. You know, I lived in a clean, sober house, but I wasn't, you know, whatever. And I was like, we can have it in my house, you know. And we had it out in my yard, pitched up a tarp, and had the elections there. And they had called out this one position. Mind you, I had never done anything before, anything of that magnitude. I didn't know what I was doing. And I raised my hand, again, God, because I don't, you know, normally put myself out there. And I became the printing chair for the host of the IKIPA. They came out to Hawaii. And so I started getting into service that way, through that avenue. And 8 guys came down from this area to spend the summer to go surfing. And then we had the World Conference in San Diego. And I got to go out to that. And I was hanging out with, you know, with this crowd of people. And they seemed very, you know, at first, you know, everyone was all, like, excited about them. And I thought they were all gay and, you know, whatever. And mind you, at that point, I was a local girl. And we don't date Hollies, which are white men. And I was a jerk. But anyway. But, you know, there was something about them. You know, they came in. They took all the service positions, you know, the people I got sober with, you know, you'd raise your, they'd announce a service position, they'd have to, like, wait or, like, pick somebody, because nobody would be, you know, eager to do service. But these people came in, and, you know, in the group I'm in now, it's hard to get a service position. Everyone's raising their hand for a service position, you know what I mean? And I was hanging out with them, and we all went to the World, and I met, like, God knows, a million other people there for the World, and, you know, it was lights out, and they were turning on lights and opening books and writing their inventories. And I was like, what is that? I had never seen it before because I'd never done my inventory. And at this point, I was 18 months sober, you know. And you know, somebody came up with the idea that, why don't I, you know, move over to, you know, the D.C. area. And I was like, yeah, it sounds great. Sold all my stuff, which didn't really consist of much. But I sold my stuff, and I decided to move over to, you know, D.C. area. And I almost didn't make it on that plane, you know, because being 18 months sober, I was crazy. Like I told you, I didn't really wasn't working with a sponsor. I had just gotten, you know, someone at that point that I had met from this area. I was really crazy. I was like the tornado, you know, rolling through lives, everybody. And of course, you know, I didn't see it until it was like, you know, pointed out in my face. And then I was embarrassed, didn't want to come down there, you know. But again, something just got me on the plane, you know. And I cannot tell you what kind of things have changed my life from just getting on that plane, you know. And I can almost guarantee, now nothing that Hawaii won't keep you sober, But I can't stay. Obviously, I did all my drinking there and everything, and I wasn't able to stay sober there. And the type of AA is not what I need to stay sober there. And so I started, you know, getting active in service when I moved here, you know, started sponsoring people, you know, doing all these kind of different things, and got my GED because I ended up dropping out of high school because I couldn't stay sober, even at that outpatient little trailer thing. I don't even know what you call it. And, you know, so I finally got my GED. I started to go back to school. You know, I'd gotten a degree, although I'm not using that anymore because I got a degree in massage therapy and it hurt my back. So then I started going back into the nursing field. And you know, life has gotten, I couldn't even tell you, though. I can't say, you know, life, there's definitely ups and downs in my sobriety. There's been good points, there's been bad points. But anything outweighs my life when it was when I was drinking. You know what I mean? And it's so funny because I could always, I was actually just talking to my sponsor about this the other night, I could very quickly forget, you know, I'm coming up on 15 years in like in a week and a half, you know, I could very quickly forget what it was like, you know, and, you know, maybe it wasn't that bad, you know, really, you know, I didn't really have all that much to lose, and mind you, no one wanted to hang out with me, and I drank like a fish, and I couldn't stay sober, you know, and I was very violent. People definitely didn't want me around. But, you know, and I could definitely get there when I'm not doing this, you know. And I've done so many things here that I could never even imagine doing when I was drinking or, you know, even at the beginning of my sobriety. You know, I've traveled the world to different AA events. You know, I've gone to Canada and, you know, all over the place for the World Conference and learned how to ski. Actually learned how to self-hygiene, balance my checkbook, you know. I actually brushed my hair and put on makeup. Oh, it probably doesn't look like it now, but, you know, put on makeup and, you know, actually look presentable, you know. And whenever I met my home group now, I laugh because at that point I had broken my ankle, so I had this fluorescent green cast up to my knee with a rainbow shoe and these cut off super big, really, like, for someone five times my size, Quicksilver pants that were cut off and this plaid button-up shirt. And I never brushed my hair, never put on makeup, and I don't know if you remember that outfit, but it was pretty horrible. And you know, that's, you know, even sober, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I can't do this by myself. You know, like I said, I've gone through a couple different, you know, sponsors. And, you know, thank God, you know, God put Beth in my life because, you know, she's definitely helped me so many different ways. And luckily for me, you know, we've both got kids around the same age, so I can't use that excuse. Well, she doesn't understand. She doesn't have a 3-year-old or a 5-year-old because her kid's the same age, you know, and, except I have one extra, I've got twins, but that's the only difference, and, but, you know, and my kids, they love coming around, I bring them to meetings with me, you know, sometimes it's the only way I can get there, and thank God, you know, the group I go to has babysitting, you know, there's a couple meetings that meet earlier that have babysitting and I'm able to go, you know, and, my husband's an AA too, part-time, no, I shouldn't say that, I'm sorry, but, you know, and I've gotten to do anything I've wanted to do sober, you know, anything I've aspired to do, I've been able to do, and I have friends, when I was pregnant with my twins, I was on bed rest for a long time, and I was in the hospital for a month. People brought meetings to me to the hospital, they brought meetings into my house. You know, they brought me dinner afterwards. Like I said, when I first moved here, I didn't have any family. I didn't really know anybody. And I had a family, a family that took me in every Thanksgiving and Christmas. I was never alone. I've never been alone. You know, I'm not alone coming here, you know. One of my friends was supposed to come with me, and she couldn't come. And I was like, hey. And it was like, no problem. And then I had another friend that was like, yeah, I want to come too, you know. And then we swooped up and picked my sponsor up from work on the way over, you know. And, you know, and I'm so grateful for my life today, you know, and I know that if I were to pick up a drink, my life would completely be different, it would completely change, and all the gifts that I have in my life would go away, and because I'm the type of person, you know, I still have one child in diapers, I've got to get my diapers, but, you know, if I was still drinking, who knows when that diaper would get changed, or, you know, the neglect, or, you know, because the type of person that I was, you know, I'd probably leave them somewhere, you know. And you know, I don't ever want my kids to have the kind of childhood that I had. You know, I don't want them to see that. I don't want them to see, you know, me ever having a drink and the kind of person I am. Because I just change. I'm like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. When I drink, I am like a completely different person, and I am nasty. And I can be nasty sober when I'm not doing what I gotta do, too, you know. And, I gotta start talking slower. And, you know, like, with my dad, you know, like I said, he's still an alcoholic, and I'm still working on that relationship, but it's gotten better. You know, when he was in prison for a while, I didn't want anything to do with him. And when he got out, all of a sudden, he wanted a relationship with me, and I didn't feel like he deserved it, you know. And I was sober even when he got out. And my sponsor at the time had told me to write, you know, send cards with my anniversary chip every year. And believe it or not, you're not supposed to get a medallion in the mail through a prison mail. You're not supposed to get it. I don't know how he did, but he got it. And he called me. He's like, you will never believe. And I didn't know when I first sent it that he wouldn't be able to get it. I was like, it's a coin, for Pete's sake. What are they going to do? You know, they can't kill somebody with a coin or whatever it is that they don't want him to have it for. And he called me when he got it. He's like, you'll never. He said, did you send me your AA medallion coin? I was like, yeah. He's like, I don't know how this came in, but it came in, you know, the warden sent it through. None of them after that made it through, but I did send it to him for a while after he got out and stuff. But you know, and making that, I got to make a verbal amends with him and my grandparents, and my mom has been the hardest one. I've tried a lot of different avenues. I mean, for the most part today, I feel pretty a little bit comfortable. I feel like there's still something, but. I think I just need to, you know, think more happy thoughts of her or celebrate her more, anyway. So I had sent letters out, because, you know, it talks about sending a letter to an anonymous address for someone who's died. I've tried going to visit the grave and talking to her and making amends at the gravesite. That hasn't worked. And then this guy named Johnny H., out in California had recommended, celebrating her on a date, her birthday, her anniversary, or whatever. And I kind of fell short of it last year, but I'm going to try it again this year, and we'll see. But you know, definitely, it helped a lot, and I don't remember even who told me this, but someone said, when you have children, it will help, and you'll understand, you know. And I can kind of see how, you know, she did the best with what she could, and she's an alcoholic, you know. But it's still hard knowing what I've done to her, you know, regardless of, you know, all the other stuff, you know, like beating her up when she was drunk and stuff like that. And that's not something I want to tell people, you know. I don't work there anymore, but if I told people that I used to beat my mom when she was drunk, they'd probably fire me or never talk to me again. I mean, people don't, you know, or whatever. And I am definitely not like normal people. And people would ask me questions at work, and I'd kind of talk to them a little bit, and they would look at me funny. So I definitely have to, you know, filter what I what I tell those people, because they don't understand, or they're like, oh my God, what? Like, you had what kind of a life? And you look normal, you know. And and I do, only thanks to this program, you know. And but you know, I can't thank AA enough for what it's given me, and it's given me everything. It's given me a life, you know. I mean, who would have, Randy even, you know, I met her in the 90s, yes, somewhere, some Icky Paw event, yeah, and, or something about some, I saw Beth, you had some dog, I don't know if it's real or not. Oh, you did have a dog, okay, good. Sometimes things are a little fuzzy, and I don't always know if it's true or not. Because I used to make up stuff when I was a kid to kind of filter in stuff. And my dad told me I used to make up this other golden retriever. You had a golden retriever too, right? Okay, so I thought it might have been some of that fuzzy stuff going on. But I don't know. I definitely know that, you know, I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be here in Madison, Virginia, with all you people. And it's definitely a long ride, but it was fun to hang out with two of my sister pigeons and my sponsor. And to get to know people all over, you know, like, God, you can go anywhere in AA. I visited all kinds of places, and there's always AA there, and it always makes me feel comfortable, you know. No matter what's going on with me, I could sit in a room of AA and just feel okay. Just breathe, you know. Just know that I'm here, and that people understand me, and I no longer feel like that alien with five heads, you know. Before I even started drinking, I couldn't even explain what I felt like, but definitely not anything. And I hope all that made sense. It felt kind of jumbled to me, but I'm really grateful to be here, so thanks.